Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. And to say that our guest, Judy Collins, is one of the leading singers of the 60s and 70s is a very watery introduction, as my co-host here, Tara McConnell, would in fact... You'd agree with that.
I would. I would say...
That's kind of a hackneyed
title. The 80s, the 90s, the noughts, and the noughties.
But, Judy Collins, you are very welcome, and we got to see a lot of you in Ireland. And when we were there with John Leahy and Quinnipiac University,
yes,
and doing
yes.
the... It's great, but you had been singing Ireland, Irish songs for decades.
Yes. I was born into the sound of Danny Boy and I'll Take You Home Again, Kathleen.
Yeah.
And I was born listening to those songs. My dad sang them all, and
yeah.
he loved them all. He knew them all. He was a great singer.
Right.
Good.
Was he a musician?
Yes. He was. He was a pianist. He played beautifully. He had a
right.
radio show for 30 years, singing all the songs of Rodgers and Hart and Irish songs
sure.
too.
Yeah. Well, of course, you had Irving Berlin. You had so many of the Irish theme songs that came out
yes.
of that whole.
Yes. Exactly.
Now you started and you were born and bred and buttered in Seattle, Washington.
Yes.
Okay.
I was.
To us, that seems like that's on another planet.
Yes.
But that's because we're lucky we made it from Ireland this far
yes,
over on the East Coast.
Of course.
What was that like? Were you in, was it an urban area?
Well, we were right in Seattle, but it was very, it was different, you know. It was more... homey and
mm-hmm.
neighborly, lots of neighbors. And I was only there 4 years. And then my father started his radio show in Seattle in 1937.
Yes.
Met my mother, I think, about 4 days before he did his debut radio show
mm-hmm.
in Seattle. And then when I was born in 39, so I had 4 years there. So I guess they were there together for six years. And then we moved to Los Angeles because he got a job in Hollywood.
Oh, boy.
And the big time, and interviewed people like Bob Hope and Red Skelton and George Shearing and lots of great stars and carried on. And
yeah.
then we moved to Denver where he had a similar radio show. So
right.
it was radio and all the people who came through town would stop and be interviewed on his show.
Yeah. And was it mostly, artists, celebrities? Did he do, in talk show, did he cover many topics?
Yes, he did. He would interview people and then it would come to dinner. So that was also part of it.
Yeah.
The entertainment went on after
right.
the radio show. And so I was surrounded by music the whole time, really. And then I studied the piano and
yeah.
learned. So I was singing Rodgers and Hart at times and singing folk songs at times, which I didn't really know. I didn't know that they were called folk songs,
mm-hmm.
Danny Boy and so on. And then I'd be playing with an orchestra next week, you know,
right.
playing Mozart with a symphony.
Right.
So it was a very eclectic and, let's say, ever-changing but very demanding childhood.
Right. How did your parents, where did they see you professionally? You started, as you say, as a classical pianist.
Yes, but I did everything. So from the beginning, I was on my dad's show singing Rodgers and Hart shows,
okay.
songs with him.
All right.
And
so it wasn't like a total breakaway.
Not at all. There was a whole mixture all the time.
Yeah.
I was either playing and singing on a school show.
Right.
Got on my father's radio show. He would have me come on, and we would sing duets of I've loved those dear hearts and gentle people.
Yeah.
And then I'd go home and practice Mozart, and then the next day at school I'd be maybe performing in a school show. And I just talked to my friend Marcia. Marcia and Carol and I were best buddies from grade school, and we had a little group called the Little Reds, and we used to do a performance of something of the little story of Little Red Riding Hood.
Yes.
They would dance the stories, and I would play them at the piano and tell about this story of the Little Red Riding Hood. And then I was looking for material, and this is where I started singing folk songs for a living, that I heard the Gypsy Rover on the radio.
Wow.
In a movie score. Mm-hmm. Recording.
Yes.
from an Alan Ladd movie called The Black Knight, I think it was called. And then I heard Joe Stafford singing Barbara Allen.
Yeah. Oh my God, yeah.
So that's what really changed my life when I was 15.
When you were mentioning Gypsy Rover there and where it came from, I noticed that Charlie McConnell and myself were here nodding like we knew that all along.
Oh,
never.
Well.
The guy who sang it on that score was called, I had it just a minute ago. Anyway, his name was McGuire, I think, and he was from Dublin.
Yeah.
Well, of course, we know it from the Clancy Brothers.
Oh,
and the
absolutely.
Clancy sang it.
Yeah.
They featured in your story as well.
Oh, sure. Well, I got to know them as soon as I bought their records when I was 14, 15, mm-hmm. 16 years old, just learning all the songs and getting accustomed to the fact that I was not going to be a classical pianist. I was going to be a folk singer.
Right. Now, commercially, was that you weren't an overnight sensation where bank managers were running after you?
I'm still waiting for the bank. Well, where are they?
No, but it was kind of it was a tough grind.
Oh yes.
Then and
yes.
It was. And when you say now that you playing professionally, where and how did you get booked? And at what point were you a soloist? Were you a singer in a band? How would you describe it?
Well, I did have a very short band experience. I sang Rodgers and Hart songs dressed in a short dress, you know, with high heels and a Dorothy Collins haircut, with a dance band called the Jack Blue Dance Band. That was about 2 weeks, and then they found out I was only 16. But I you're always trying to figure out something else to do besides babysitting.
I know.
And selling wreaths at Christmas to make your money.
Yeah.
But I was, when I was 16, one of my, by now I'm playing the guitar all the time, going to the mountains for the meetings of the Denver Folklore Society, drinking like a fish already.
Mm-mm.
And gathering songs, and one of my friends in school, her father knew about the Kiwanis Club mm-hmm. contest, so I was voted, you know, an American Idol of 1956,
mm-hmm.
and they gave me some money and sent me to Atlantic City where I sang at their international convention, but I didn't do any other things that were professional until I was 19, and I got a job at a club in Boulder, Colorado, where I was living. Because I'd been singing all along, singing everywhere, singing at the school shows, singing at the fundraisers, singing at this and that, the parties, whatever. But I got a job singing for money, and that was 55 years ago.
Mm.
So that worked out
so that
pretty
was,
well.
That worked out. That worked out indeed.
Yeah.
We do know, if we can fast forward a little bit, not a little bit, a lot. Tarla, you were very instrumental first of all, when you were saying that Judy Collins should be in Ireland and she, she should tour Ireland and she did, you know.
Well,
I said, wait a minute. She's going to do that now, when in fact she is the whole of America that, you know, say, hey, you don't have to go anywhere?
Well, I always knew, because, you know, of course, I've always been a fan of Judy's, but I always knew there was an Irishness in Judy that would sort of peep out every now and again at a concert, and it would sort of raise its head and say, you know, attention must be paid to this Irishness. And then Judy had a spectacular television concert at the Metropolitan Museum.
Right.
Was it 2 years ago, 3 years ago?
2012, yeah. we recorded it.
At the Temple of Dendar. And I knew that that was a very significant show because, you know, I saw it so many times on PBS, but also the setting and the whole thing. And then one day I had the good fortune to be up at the Met and with a mutual friend of Judy's and mine, Harold Holzer. And Judy said, hey, I'm going to do my next show in Ireland. So I thought, finally, the eagle has landed. Finally, Judy's going to go to Ireland. And I want to be part of that, I thought. I just wanted to help in some way.
Yeah.
So fortunately, I went along to our good friends at Quinnipiac. And they said we would like to support that show.
Also, Tom Moran was very...
Tom was involved as well.
Very,
yeah.
And very supportive, and of course still is. But, you know...
Yeah.
So things started happening, that Irish stuff kind of... it really like a tumbleweed from once
it
to
did. You know, as Trilla said, I've always wanted to do this show.
Yeah.
I've dreamed about it. I've talked to PBS about it for years. And finally, when they gave me the green light, and then, you know, we simply could not have done it without Tom and without Quinnipiac.
Sure, John Lee.
And some other generous donors. And so it was the right time in the right place. And also it was a big summer for Irish things altogether. The new Ross concert with the celebration of the Kennedy visit there 50 years ago. And having all the Kennedys there. And
that was pretty spectacular.
So special. So everything kind of conspired to make it all happen. Also, my Patricia Hardy, who's the publisher of Irish American
decided
Magazine. Kind of honor me, and it made me think more about it. She also found me a genealogist who has done some very, very good research on my family to find out exactly where we came from.
Right.
So on top of everything else, I was given the gift of a new song, which is always very special for a songwriter. And the new song turned out to be called New Moon Over the Hudson, and is really about the Irish diaspora in my own family, of course.
Yes.
But the idea that so many people came over, and many during the famine years, during the hunger years, and how, you know, I have a line in the song that says that the ships that brought us over here were made of tears and smoke, and I'm sure that's pretty close to being accurate.
Another great line in that song that it just chills me every time you sing it, about them fighting in the Civil War.
Oh, my father's father's fathers, they came from Irish shores. They played the drums in Lexington and fought the Civil Wars. They died to save the Union. They lived to see me born, and in their hearts they held the Irish morn. So... You know, that's now they came in. My own family came in. My own history came in. Ancestors came in the probably 1730s, something like that. Probably from Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
Although I'm convinced that we have other relatives who went south, and perhaps there is a connection with Cork there and Michael Collins. I mean, he could be a relative. I didn't even know. So we're doing the DNA testing now to find out about that.
Wow. Hey, Tarla,
well,
if Judy is related to you, I know exactly.
Well, Judy was at the Hall of Fame last week because Irish America had inducted Judy into the year before. But I think sitting with you was Bill O'Reilly.
Yeah.
And I was hoping somebody would ask Bill O'Reilly if he'd write a new book called Who Killed Michael Collins? You know, we'll get his take on that.
But I have a brother named Michael Collins
who
keeps getting stopped in the airlines.
Now, you're the eldest of five.
I am.
Any other members of your siblings? take up music? Or?
Not professionally, although they're all very musical. My sister doesn't really admit to being a singer, but she can carry a tune, so that's good. And my brothers are pretty good. One of my brothers even collects guitars and plays quite well. My brother Denver plays very well. He's a filmmaker. The middle one is a doctor, and the oldest one's a filmmaker, and then the middle one is a construct. He's really an artist with wood. He works with wood, so they're very artistically driven, and so the genes are around.
Now you still have a rather hectic schedule in the sense that for anybody who think you must be living high off your traveling from mansion to mansion
or from Manchester to Manchester.
No, but you do, and what does it feel like, and who is your audience? What do you find when you go to places and people say, I remember this? Or
well, I go, I travel, I do about 120 shows a year all over the country and sometimes the world. Mm-hmm. And I sing in wonderful performance art centers. I sing in big arenas. I sing by myself with a guitar and piano. Sometimes we add water and have a band. Monday night we'll be doing something that honors, not this one Monday, but a week from. Big concert to honor Paul Simon and singing one of his songs with a nice big band. But large, small, I do all kinds of sizes. Yeah. The audience is enormously struck. A lot of breadth with age, young kids come. I go to places like Taiwan and Hong Kong and Korea, and I've done a lot, and I do a lot of traveling in Australia, New Zealand, Europe, the UK, of course, Ireland.
Right.
And I come to Ireland not irregularly. Every two or three years I have a show or more there, and, of course, go to England. So my life is, and I write books, which I love to do, and have a wonderful life.
Tell
very
us a little
creative.
Bit about books and what topics and what others.
Well, it's mostly memoir, although I did write a thriller about the music business in 1995. It was published called Shameless, and I'm writing a new book, but it's mostly about memoir. I've written 9 books now, and I
it's a very good topic.
It is a good topic. Well, my father really had a very interesting life, and that's where it all started. I started in my first songbook, which came out in 1969. I wrote 7 chapters about my exotic and eccentric family, among other things.
Yes.
And then I went on, as I write memoirs, I find myself dwelling at times on the family story, but then there are personal stories. I've written books about suicide, about creativity, about surviving loss, because my son died 22 years ago by his own hand. So I'm a suicide survivor, which makes me, and sometimes in my touring in Europe, people will say, well, it's fine that you've come here to sing, but why don't you come and talk on our radio show about your experiences with this, because we're having real trouble in various places. Belfast, of course, parts of the UK, parts of Europe. And
unfortunately
true that we have issues.
Yeah.
And so I do a lot of talking. The speaking engagements that I do in this country have mostly to do with mental health now. I do about a dozen a year of those.
Is there a common thread? And I know when it comes to suicide, there's hardly anything that's a common theme or thread, but as you travel to, since you're a world traveler, is there something that you expect when people talk to you or want to talk to you about? Is there some particular aspect of suicide that sticks out?
Well, I must say that the question of drug use and alcoholism is always very high on the list. And, of course, untreated mental illness, depression, for one. Although my friend who's gone now, Ed Schneiman, used to say, you can be depressed all your life. Doesn't mean you're going to take your life. Some people have that particular, whatever you want to call it, issue, and some don't. And the suicide rates have stayed pretty steady based on the population, which is an interesting thing, given that our population rises all the time, but our suicide numbers don't seem to rise beyond about 35,000 known suicides.
Right.
Acknowledged. There are many that are unacknowledged, of course. But those issues, the issue of addiction, which of course
right.
means that one of the avenues of access to suicidal thoughts is treatment, and treatment is available, and alcoholism and drug addiction are illnesses which can be treated and can have good results. So there's that, which is something
right.
positive.
In detection, for those who are who seem to be the element of shock after
mm-hmm.
a suicide,
mm-hmm.
that seems like there hasn't been much progress made in that area in terms of detection of, like, what are the telltale signs. Is there what are your views on that, or is there research done on that?
Well, the thing that is predominant and important is to know that you must talk about it.
Mm.
As a survivor of a suicide, survivors of suicide are increasingly more prone to suicide, their own suicides. So the issue is to keep talking about it, to get mental, to get help,
yes.
to get therapy, to join a group of survivors, to do everything you can to get your own mental health squared away,
mm-hmm.
To try not to use drugs or alcohol during
right.
your recovery process, because it covers things up and makes it
right.
much harder to get to the essence of why you're recovering. When Clark died, Joan Rivers called me in about 4 days later, and she said, I want you to know for two things. First of all, she said, you cannot shut your life down, which I was planning on doing. I thought, well, this is it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm canceling everything, which I was going to do. And she said, you can't do that because you won't recover if you do that. And the other thing she said was, there are no guilts in suicide. You didn't cause it. You couldn't have seen it coming. And if you did stop it once, you couldn't stop it the second. You know,
yeah,
who knows?
I know, yeah.
So there are no guilts in suicide. Guilt destroys people's sense of authenticity and their sense of comfort and health, you know, mental health. So guilt is to be avoided at all,
yeah,
in all possible ways. Therapy, talking about it. Talk about it until you don't want to talk about it anymore.
Mm.
And being open about it, because this is an issue that everybody has a problem with somewhere in their family. And no matter how many people you talk to, you will find that most of them, they have an uncle, they have a godchild,
right.
they have a next-door neighbor, they have, because it's not something which doesn't happen in people's lives. It does. So it's good to talk about it. You know, what, after all, you know, Camus is the one who said it's the essential philosophical question of one's life. Suicide or no suicide.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to think about it, talk about it. And there is recovery. That's what's also possible. My friend Schneiben also said everybody can recover from suicidal ideology if they have therapy, talk therapy,
mm-hmm.
which,
right.
of course, the insurance companies don't want to pay for. So if you can't get it and pay for it, you get it and get it for free somewhere. Go online.
Mm-hmm.
What can I say?
Yeah. Yeah.
Let me ask you about in some of your songs, and indeed in your own, to hear a Judy Collins song sung is different. I mean, I don't know how many times we can hear Danny Boy, or if actually we'd even need to hear it one more time. But
you,
well, let me tell you, I've heard Judy sing Danny Boy three times in one night. when Judy was recording the concert at Dromoland Castle,
yeah.
it was pretty phenomenal because we were in that concert hall for about 3 hours.
Yeah,
it seemed like, you know, it didn't seem like that, but it was about 3 hours, and it was Judy has an amazing technique that everybody in that room felt that they were part of a really special recording session.
Mm-hmm.
So they, you know, they just said, okay, Judy, you're leading us. Take us away. And Judy would sing Danny Boy at the end of the night, which this is what I find stunning.
Yeah.
It was the last song on the program. She sang at the end of the night, and she wasn't happy with the first take, and she wasn't happy with the second take. And none of us, we couldn't hear where is this thing that she hears. And then third take, she got it. But let me tell you, we sat there 3 hours in the concert, and Judy's voice at the end of the night was as pure as it was at the beginning of the night. Now tell me, Judy, how do you do that?
Well, I have a technique that I've always been lucky enough to be to have accessible. I've studied for many years to get it. And I try to get enough rest. I try to eat the right things. I don't get sick most of the time. That's thank God. And I know what to do. I always say, my sister says, how is it going, you know? And I say, well, if I don't know how to do it by this time, I better hang up my shingle.
Of the great number of artists and songs that you have taken and adapted, like Bob Dylan, like several
Leonard Cohen.
Yeah, Leonard. Are there the ones that come to you automatically? If somebody said, okay, what order? Does that depend on the day and the time? And the
It does, because after all, I have 52 years, I guess, of recording. But I have a lifetime of songs.
Yeah.
So, and I also dip into various parts of my life to pull out, you know, I'll sing something from Guys and Dolls if it strikes me.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You have great control with guitar, too, because actually you don't have to turn around and humor an orchestra. You can go on there and let everybody else catch up with you.
If I'm doing something a cappella, doesn't matter. I just sing it.
Sure.
And sing a part of it. And my musical director is so quick, and he's so good. If I start, you know, where or when, he'll jump into it in the right key. So and that's after many years of working together.
Absolutely.
So it takes a long time to do that. But there are many ways in which all of the past is available in terms of at least doing some piece of a song that you remember.
Right. It was very special indeed, PBS WNET Channel 13 presentation. And Judy Collins in concert, live from Ireland. Now, what wound up on the cutting room floor?
Nothing.
Really?
No.
Wow.
In fact, we did a lot of interviews, quite a session of interviews. Nothing wound up eliminated because we did everything that we did on the concert. We did, I think, 10 songs on the CD, on the DVD, and then we had 3 more which we put on the CD. So nothing was lost. The both versions of Danny Boy didn't make it, only one. So, but everything else was on the show, and we had been lucky because we found a wonderful orchestra of beautiful players. Frank Gallagher was playing the pipes and the fiddle, and a wonderful Aeolian pipe player and guitarist. And it sounded very Irish,
and a great television crew.
They were wonderful. Guests were wonderful. Mary Black was on the show, and the little dancer from America, the American Irish step dancer, who's 9, I think, now. And Ari Hest, who was wonderful, sang a terrific one of his songs with me. So everything that we did, it's different. You know, you sometimes in making a movie, you shoot 99 to 1 or something.
Oh, I know, yes. And actually, in a recording session that you did in Lincoln Center, was one of the things that Tom Moran was Mutual was very involved into. It was amazing that, again, the control you have as a musician and as a guitarist, that you don't have to go back and take it from the top.
No, most of the time.
Yeah.
You get it.
You get it. And that actually, that's... So you're thinking ahead. I mean, you know, when you're saying that she sang it three times, maybe she sang 9 different verses because she definitely knows how to... That it's almost like the like cutting and pasting.
Yes,
you know, and from the old,
right.
You know,
that's
and
right.
From the old reel to reel, that's what you did. You took a piece and you cut out that. Is there a particular, say, the best of Judy Collins that you have in your head?
That's a good question. I think that...
Should I ask again in 5 years?
Well, I think... it might change some, but if I did a best of my work, it would probably be different than other people's favorites, and they might not know the songs.
Right.
But I would say that a lot of my own writing would be on that list. A lot of my own writing, including New Moon Over the Hudson.
Absolutely.
The song I wrote for my mother... Two years ago when she died in the twilight.
Yes.
The Blizzard would absolutely be on the list, which I wrote in 89. Since You've Asked, probably Albatross would be on that list.
Yes.
My father would be on that list.
Mm-hmm.
Then I would venture into some of the songs that I have recorded, certainly the Dylan songs, Tom Thumb's Blues, the early, all of the things I've done of Leonard Cohen's, just extraordinary. In fact, a lot of artists re-record songs for new packages because then they don't have to pay the record label and so on.
Yeah.
But when I put out my Leonard Cohen album, I wanted people to hear the way they were recorded. They were so special, 66, 67, right up through 89, 90. They were so phenomenal, from Suzanne and Dress Rehearsal Rag to even, I would say that perhaps I'd have to take Bird on the Wire off that list, but things like The Story of Isaac and Joan of Arc and Priests and Sisters of Mercy.
Right.
I mean, they were spectacular recordings, and I really wanted people to hear the way we did them. So I had to license them from Elektra, and then I recorded songs that I hadn't done of his, Democracy and a couple of others. They would be on the list. I think, of course, Then in the Clouds would be on the list.
Are you doing did I hear you were going to do a concert of Sondheim songs?
Yes, I'm working on it now. We're going to do a big orchestral tour of a big Judy Collins sings Sondheim. Mm-hmm. I was going to do it years ago, and it wasn't the right time. Didn't work out, but it's time now. I'm far enough away from it, and I do own a piece of the property, after all.
Wonderful.
I mean, I certainly own it emotionally, if not physically.
The CD, by the way, friends, is Judy Collins live in Ireland. And where is this? Oh, well,
Castle Dromoland.
Castle Dromoland. Oh,
In County Clare.
Right. Absolutely, absolutely. But some lovely. There are some lovely.
Place.
And that bonus track, Barbara Allen, Digging Up Barbara Allen. Now that's very special.
It is very special.
What was the biggest surprise for you, Judy, in your newfound relationship with Ireland?
What would it be?
The drink. The late night.
Yeah.
Well, it has to be. It has to also be, to some degree, the discovery of Amazing Grace up in Donegal.
Oh, you know what? That's right. To find out that the shipwreck that changed John Newton's life happened off the off Kerry. It's
Donegal.
It's Donegal.
Yeah. Donegal.
And he came into Derry, and that's where the conversion.
That's remarkable, because that has such power for me.
Yeah.
Since I'd sung the song for so long, and since my grandmother taught it to me.
My God, yeah. All right. Well, of course, Darla was setting you up there. He just wanted
Donegal.
Just wanted to get
Donegal,
somehow.
You're right. And they're doing they're doing now a monument of some sort.
And they want you back for
that. They want me back for that. Yeah. We tried to do it when we were there, but it was not possible. But we'll go back. We'll do it when we go back.
Now, you have a couple of CDs, you know, Bohemian, Judy Collins, and that's Wildflower Records, right here in New York City.
Yes, I started a record label a few years ago, and
good
I
for
still
you.
Have it. So these things are all part of that effort.
Right. Okay. And you have a website, www.judycollins.com.
Yes, and our merchandise section will be working within a few days.
Really? It's a much easier website than Tara McConnell.
He gives me a hard time. I'm going to get it on T-shirt someday.
You have a T-shirt that will fit on? Judy, it was a delight.
Thank you.
We were very happy to be in Ireland and be there.
So wonderful.
Yes.
Yeah,
and
great.
Again, it was part of the overall Quinnipiac experience.
Yes, I mean, it was amazing.
Yeah, we just had to double check and make sure that actually you were gone to bed and that you weren't going to show up for one more song. Can I ask you to do something? I just want to just give a little bit of any song that comes to your head.
Oh, yes. Oh, Danny boy, the pipes are calling. From glen to glen and down the mountainside. That I'll let you hear the rest on the
That's terrific.
There you are.
And anyway, you cut it just at the point where Tarla was about to join you. So it would have been cut anyway. Judy,
that's right.
Thanks a million.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Judy Collins. Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA.
Great.
Thanks.